And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
High in the air, Brito back at the wall, adios, pelota!
That's the type of manager that I'd like to be, which is the same every day. They know what they're going to get. They're going to get energy, they're going to get accountability, they're going to get structure, and they're going to get support. And I'm going to bring those things to the dugout in the clubhouse regularly.
It takes hard work, and it takes humility, taking one step forward at a time, making one good baseball move after another. And I really feel like that's how we're going to get where we hope and intend to go.
You're listening to Bags and Brisby on Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 215 of the Bags and Brisby podcast. I am Grant Brisby. I'm here with Andy Baggerly, and Andy, this is a fun one. The Giants threw 215 pitches in a game, April 28th, 2018. I will give you five podcast bucks if you tell me who threw the last of those 215 pitches. He struck out the side. Or no, he didn't strike out the side. I'm sorry. Clean inning, one inning on 11 pitches.
So I thought this was going to be the easiest five podcast bucks I've ever made, because I thought you were going to ask me what ballpark it came in, and I would just say Coors Field, because why wouldn't it be Coors Field? That's where I am right now, looking out on the expanses of Coors Field following the Giants sweep here. But that's not what you're asking me. You're asking me which pitcher, 2018?
2018, I will give you a big whopping hint. The Dodgers won the game 15-6.
Boy, gosh, I am drawing a blank.
Great changeup. Great changeup. Fast pace.
Reyes Maranta.
Pablo Sandoval. That was the debut.
Pablo Sandoval. Wow.
That was the debut of Pablo. Let Pablo pitch. He pitched one of the best position player. Back when position players pitching was fun, that was the most fun you could ever have with a position player pitching.
Man, you know what? I saw it once a long time ago when I was covering the Dodgers, and they were just beating up on the Diamondbacks in Arizona. And so the Diamondbacks put Mark Grace on the mound. And, you know, back then they had Mike Fetters, and Mike Fetters had his signature move, which is he'd take a big deep breath on the mound. And then all of a sudden he'd jerk his neck so fast he thought he'd snap it, and he'd look in for the sign. And so that's what Grace did. He clowned his Fetters impersonation. It busted everybody up. It was hilarious. And a rookie guy named David Ross came up, and he hit his first major league home run off Mark Grace. And afterwards, Mark Grace said, well, I didn't have a scouting report on him, but I guess he can hit a 65 mile an hour fastball. So, and David Ross would go on to hit a homer in game 7 of the World Series for the Chicago Cubs. Who would have thunk it? But yeah, that's all a roundabout way of saying they used to be some of the most fun things, and you'd just be like, please give me like one of those a year. But right. I think it's kind of ruined now.
It is passé. And I don't want to belabor this little Easter egg, but I will give you 5,000 podcast bucks if you tell me the reliever who came in to relieve Chris Stratton in that game. He pitched 3 1/3 innings. Give me the reliever. Because honestly, you could have given me $1 million actual dollars and I never would have gotten it.
Wow. Okay. So I'm guessing it wasn't like an obvious guy like Mark Melanson or Corey Guerin. I don't know. How about let's go with Derek Law.
Close. He came in after Roberto Gomez. Give me your top five Roberto Gomez memories.
Yeah, I don't have any. Is he a welterweight? Yeah,
oh my
I'm
goodness!
Not sure.
The weirdest thing about it is when I went, wow, I do not remember that guy at all. He pitched in two separate seasons for the Giants. He also appeared in four games in 2017. Zero memory, and I apologize to Gomez and the Gomez family.
I don't know what it is, but Roberto Gomez just sounds like a boxing name to me. Yeah, I don't know what boxing. It is. It's just the Roberto Duran kind of a thing.
Oh, that's a good one. All right, but we are most definitely not here to talk about Roberto Gomez. We're here to talk about the Giants in, by gum, they have another September sweep in Coors Field. I didn't think I would see one of those in my lifetime. Now they're two in back-to-back seasons. Is the end nigh?
You know, it's funny. Last year aside, it seems like the more the Giants have on the line when they come to this ballpark, the more it becomes a chamber of horrors. And it doesn't matter if the Rockies are good or not. I mean, you know, the ghost of Nephi Perez is strong in the force here. But yeah, so they come here with, you know, really nothing to play for other than pride and trying to, you know, look good for to end the season. And they throw two bullpen games. They're really compromised in terms of innings. And what do? They sweep a four-game series. So, yeah, baseball, you never know.
Not only do they sweep a four-game series, like you said, bullpen games. Do you tell me bullpen games in Coors Field? I'm anticipating at least 18 combined runs. 18 and a half is the over-under. The Giants in the last two games allowed one run. They barely missed a shutout on Wednesday, and they got the shutout, the first shutout since Barry Zito's masterpiece in 2012. Wow. It's amazing. Yeah, it's just amazing. It's Coors Field. Should we not be scared of Coors Field anymore? I don't buy it.
Yeah, I think you go into a series like this when you have to throw two bullpen games and think, okay, let's just make sure we don't have any like Civil War era saw-like surgeries here. Nobody loses any limbs. Yeah, you know what? And not only that, what I was impressed by is the defense. The defense in a place that's really tough and an outfield that's really big. And a couple plays, you know, weren't made here today, Thursday. There's a ball that dropped in with, of course, Tyler Rogers on the mound, and Luis Gonzalez kind of broke a little late on it. There's a ball that Brandon Crawford was a little indecisive on, and he only got one out instead of two. But then Crawford made a number of fantastic plays, including probably one of his best plays all season. Mike Yastrzemski made a really nice play. And, you know, we haven't seen really good defense from this team all year. And so to see them really flash the leather pretty much the extent of the four games in probably the toughest place to play defense, I don't know if that bodes well for anything, but it's just kind of refreshing.
I'm glad you brought that up because we haven't talked about the defense in a while, and I do think that it's better than it was, and where it was the worst in the National League, at least, if not the worst in both leagues. But it was fantastic. And when you say, okay, the defense has been so bad this season, the Giants defense has been one of the reasons why they are not even sniffing the playoffs right now. Well, what's gone wrong? And you can point to some obvious, okay, well, they play Jock Peterson in the outfield more than maybe they wanted to. Luis Gonzalez isn't a plus outfielder out there. You had this. Brandon Belt was hurt. But then you start getting to the reasons like, well, Brandon Crawford isn't as good. And part of you says, okay, you know, I guess he's 35, whatever. But then another part of you says, that shouldn't last. I don't care if he's 35. I watched a 73-year-old Omar Vizquel do wondrous things out there. And Brandon Crawford, like, he was really good just last year. And, man, he looked like his old self, at least in the field in Colorado. And it was really refreshing to see. And by old self, I mean getting that ball in the hole and rifling to second for the force out, starting the double plays, just doing everything you expect and take for granted when it comes to Brandon Crawford.
Yeah, you know, I remember Omar Vizquel back in like 2005, 2006, whatever. You had like Jeff Becerra was in his 40s on that team. Barry Bonds was in his 40s. They got Moises Alou, who was nearing 40. I think JT Snow was about 37 or 38. And yeah, that was the year that they replaced the Powerade jugs with Metamucil. And really a brilliant, brilliant marketing strategy. I'll tell you a quick story along those lines. I think about it every time I walk into the visiting clubhouse at Coors Field. They have these big black leather couches that have been there forever, and they're like in a big U, and there's a big screen TV. And I'll never ever forget walking into that clubhouse one day, and it's Barry Bonds, and he's just completely lounged out. And next to him is Steve Finley, and he is also completely lounged out. They are transfixed at what they're watching. And it was one of the daytime TV shows, and it was Celine Dion performing. And I thought, I'm not covering a young team.
Listen, I am in my mid-40s, and that the racking out part, that describes me. But Celine Dion, I don't know. Like, what would the comp be for us in 2022? Because you and I are roughly the same age, what would we be listening to or watching where someone would walk in and go, oh boy, Bags and Brisby are at it again?
You know, it's funny. I had my phone on shuffle, and a Christopher Cross song came on. I think it was it wasn't Sailing. It was the other one. I forget. But I remember thinking, because he's got such a weird voice, you know, I'm like, would a young person listen to this and be like, what in the hell is this? Or would they think it's a timeless classic? I don't know.
I think the yacht rock stuff is hip Among certain circles, amongst the youth, in part because of the revival that started with the web series Yacht Rock. But in general, you can get smooth. Like when you're talking Thundercat, do you know who Thundercat is?
No.
He's a fantastic bassist, just a fantastic musician. He straddles funk. And anyways, he had a song with Michael McDonald and Kenny Loggins on it just one album ago. Like it's hip again. So Christopher Cross, if you're listening, you're hip.
Now, what was the reference you made on Twitter? You retweeted something or responded to a years-old tweet where you made a reference to never hearing a popular song before, and I wasn't quite sure what that was about.
It was Killers, Mr. Brightside, and it is a song that apparently it's the kind of song where if it comes on a bar, people of a certain age, their 30s and up to 40s, will just start singing like every word because it's their, I don't know what the comp would be. It's their Sweet Caroline or something. And I swear to goodness, I had no memory of this song until... until that tweet, and now I'm caught up. And the very next day after that tweet, I heard it. I heard kids playing it, 13-year-olds playing it the very next day. So yeah, I don't know. Just the world's weird.
It's funny. The older you get, the more you have just like a weird like Swiss cheese hole gap in your pop culture knowledge, and then those holes just get bigger and bigger. And then you wake up here one day and it's what are these kids today listening to? So yeah, I'm gonna try to stay as young as I can.
Yeah, I'm so old. I can remember when the Giants used to lose all the time at Coors Field. How's that for reeling
what
us
a segue.
Back in?
Wow.
The bullpen has been really, really good. And listen, at this point, with bullpens, it's always you wonder if it's gold or if it's pyrite, just because of the sample sizes, just because this and that. But you wrote a very nice piece, I thought, on Tyler Rogers. When I was trying to project what the Giants might do this offseason, I penciled in Camilo Duvall as the only guaranteed spot in the bullpen. And then I hedged my bets and said, well, you can probably assume Brebbie is going to be there. And I'm sure that there are going to be a couple other holdovers. And I was thinking Tyler Rogers, but I didn't want to put it in print because I wasn't sure. And lo and behold, like a couple hours later, you get the scoop that, they're really counting on Rogers next year. And I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, I'm pro Tyler Rogers.
Yeah, it's funny. When I read that, I was like, a little Tyler Rogers erasure here. Interesting. I will tell you that when I write about Tyler Rogers, I cringe when I go into the comments because some people have just made up their mind about him. And I do think part of what we do is educational a little bit because there are some things about the game that, you know, are maybe not always super easy to figure out or don't make sense on a surface level. And the fact is Tyler Rogers has given up 3 home runs all year in 70 plus innings. And that means he's got the best home run rate of anybody who's thrown as many innings as him. And that's like 170 pitchers in the major leagues. And that's totally what this front office, what this coaching staff values is get me some non-barreled contact, get me some low exit velocity contact, and keep the ball in the ballpark and don't walk people. And obviously the walk rate has doubled and you really went underneath the hood a few weeks back with your Tyler Rogers piece, which is linked in mine. And and notice the swing rates are way, way down by almost like 8 or 10 percentage points. And that probably is leading to a lot of the walks. And so he's probably going to have to be in the strike zone a little bit more and just maybe not focus on not walking guys, but making guys swing more, however he has to make that adjustment. Still, if you throw out the one game against the Mets, which I know is sort of cheating, he's got like a 2.99 ERA and he's been fine. He's been fine. And that's with just a terrible defense behind him. So, and interestingly, Evan Longoria told me that, I don't know if you noticed this, but they never played an exaggerated shift. There's only one they've played on him all year. He's one of two pitchers along with Tim Hill that has basically not been, no one's shifted behind him all season, but they do still play exaggerated positioning. And they've tried a whole bunch of different things and nothing seems to have worked and played at different depths. Now they just play totally straight up, totally, completely straight up, and it's worked. And it could be just, that's the way the ball's bounced the last, 8 or 10 outings as he's put up zeros, or it could be that, maybe they just figured out this is the best way to play behind him. But either way, he fits what they really value. And it's going to be probably up to him to have a run of success and cut down the walks a little bit to move back into a seventh, eighth inning role. But even if he's on this team as a little bit more of a multi-inning guy who pitches earlier in games, he's still super valuable and he's still going to be worth way more than whatever he's going to make in arbitration.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that you know that you're going to hear it in the comments whenever you mention Tyler Rogers or write about Tyler Rogers. That might be one of the primary reasons that I left him off of that list in that article that I wrote, where I said, you know, Brebby is probably going to make it. And I was thinking, and probably Rogers, but I just didn't want to throw that red meat out there. And I just sort of wanted to hint at it that he's probably going to be back. But listen, since that blow up against the Mets on May 24th, that was May 24th. Again, that's a long time ago. He's pitched 44 games, 52 and a third innings with a 2.75 ERA. He's been Tyler Rogers. You know, he's allowed an OBP of 295. Like you said, he's not given up a lot of long balls. He is. But I think two things can be true. One is I'm not eager to see him in that seventh, eighth inning role again, like maybe ever. But I also think he could be very, very valuable doing what he's been doing, sixth inning, fifth inning. Maybe he comes in the second in a bullpen game, just wherever you might need him, wherever Gabe Kapler wants to use that utility knife. That's the guy for him. And he's been a little bit of a security blanket for Kapler since he arrived.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, in both bullpen games, he was the second guy up and he pitched multiple innings both times and got the win in the first game, which I don't know if you saw the piece I wrote the other day, or what I led into the Tyler Rogers piece actually was, you know, Evan Longoria was getting all of the goop out to dump on Sean Gelly for his first major league win. And then someone looks at their phone and they're like, oh, Tyler Rogers got the win, not Gelly, which is by the scoring rules, that's the way it has to work if you're the reliever who gets the lead and the team doesn't relinquish it. So the one difference is if you're a starting pitcher and you don't pitch five innings and the team takes the lead while the starter's in the game and they don't relinquish the lead, then the official scorer can pick the most effective reliever in his or her reckoning. But in this case, that wasn't the set of circumstances. So Tyler Rogers snaked the win, and Sean Gelly's going to have to just wait another day to see just how much of his 6'11 frame can be crammed into a laundry cart and wheeled into the shower.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Now, let me just show you how broken my brain is. When you said that Evan Longoria was ready to get the goop out to dump on Sean Gelly in celebration of his win, I thought, well, this brings up an interesting question. If you are Sean Gelly and Evan Longoria has carefully prepared goop, would you rather have actual jelly, like strawberry jelly, dumped on you?
Oh.
Or would you rather have KY jelly dumped on you? Which one would be more offensive, harder to get off? Which one would offend your sensibilities more?
How about a big smear of peanut butter? And then he can be peanut butter and jelly.
Oh, that's good. That's good. That maybe just a smear it all up on his hair. Yeah, that's good. That's good. I like that.
That would also be really gross to wash out, so, which is kind of the point, because it's a sense of arrested development sometimes in major league clubhouses, but they like to have fun. And, I have a notion, and I probably should save this because I want to write about it at some point, but I think that we need to fundamentally change the scoring rules around pitcher wins. And I don't think relievers should get them at all. I don't think they should get losses either. I think they should get holds or saves, and that's it. And And you know, if you win 90 games in a season, you don't have 90 saves. You have to have a set of conditions in which the reliever comes in and gets the save. I think it's the same thing for a starting pitcher. If you have a set of conditions that the starter meets, then the starter gets a win. And if he doesn't, then he doesn't get the win. And so that's what I would do. But, you know, I guess that would, they'd have to blow up like statistics from all time and then do messy things like that. So it'll never happen. But anyway, that's my idea.
I'm subscribing to your newsletter. I just will reiterate that I hate the hold, and specifically the part where it's a 5-run lead, reliever comes in, gives up 4 runs in a third of an inning, and gets the hold. I hate that. So we'll need to monkey around with that a little bit. But in general, yeah, especially with starting pitchers going shorter and shorter, you know, if you have a starting pitcher go 4 2/3 innings and give up 1 run in a game where the manager was expecting that sort of start, I don't know. That's kind of like a modern, that's a quality start in 2012, just like a weird modern quality start.
Yeah. And you say, well, what do you do with losses? And I say, well, just forget about them. Don't have losses. I mean, you have blown saves. You know, I mean, it's kind of a stat, right? So you could have like, you know, maybe like a blown win. I don't know. Maybe there's some equivalent to it. But yeah, anyway, it's never going to happen. It's just in my mind. But you know, so we can get back on the topic of discussing. Oh, I don't know. You want to talk about Aaron Judge and Barry Bonds?
I am in the middle of writing about this because of your tweets. You responded to some content produced by Buster Olney, where he said that Aaron Judge is having the most impressive baseball season of all time. Hyperbole, yeah, but I understand some of the points that are being made, where you have relievers, more relievers are throwing 95 plus. You have all of this data to sift through and attack individual hitters more than, you know, when Babe Ruth was up, it was don't throw one down the middle. But now it's, well, Aaron Judge is weak on sliders when you throw it in this zone 62% of the time. Like, you can get granular, and that is probably favorable to the pitchers. I don't know. It's tough, but give me Barry Bonds hitting 73 home runs. That is more impressive to me. Steroids or not, I don't care. Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I don't want you to give away your whole piece right here, right now. But, you know, if you're comparing eras and you're comparing, you know, stuff in the hitting environment, well, okay, we can do that. Judge is out slugging the MLB average by 309 points. He's slugging 705. Barry Bonds out slugged the league in 2001 by 436 points. He slugged 863. So yeah, it's a tougher slugging environment. The average slugging percentage is lower by 31 points. But, you know, Bonds is still, you know, head and shoulders above the league average more than Judge is. And he did it on, I got to think, way fewer pitches in the zone to swing at, which, okay, you could have pitchers throwing the nastiest stuff imaginable, but you could have a super nasty two-seamer that's running 99 miles an hour. But if it's in the zone, theoretically, you can hit it. I mean, if pitchers aren't challenging you as a hitter and you don't get anything to hit, that's even more of a certainty that you're not going to hit a home run, right? That's at least the way I look at it.
Yeah, I just, listen, I get the performance-enhancing drugs as being an asterisk, and I empathize with that because, yes, it was not something that everyone was doing in 2001, 2002. Most of the hitters, perhaps, I don't know, but it definitely allowed him to stay fresher. It allowed him to play in way more games than someone in his late 30s should have been able to play in, and it helped him recover faster, and which gives him better bat speed in September. I get all that, and that is all valid. I don't want to dismiss that out of hand, but when I look at especially 2004, when he hit 362, he had 617 plate appearances and 373 at bats. He was intentionally walked 120 times, 232 walks total, only 41 strikeouts. That's not all performance-enhancing drugs. That is just a hitter at doing things that baseball players should never, ever, ever do. That, for my money, 2004 was the most impressive season I have ever seen and will ever see.
Right, and I, you know, it was. I mean, 120 intentional walks. It's unbelievable. But, you know, I guess to play devil's advocate to you a little bit, and we did have this conversations back and forth on Slack earlier today, you know, to be walked that many times, especially intentionally, was a choice that, you know, that was not the action on Barry Bonds. That was a choice that was made externally. And yes, it was made partially, or at least mostly, because he's, you know, the most dangerous hitter on the planet. But there was also a lot of, you know, FUs, sort of a context or subtext to that. A lot of managers, Larry Durker's one that comes to mind, you know, they did not want to be a party to Barry Bonds hitting another homer and getting closer to Hank Aaron. And it really became kind of groupthink for a lot of managers. And, you know, I think that's a part of it too. I just think that season was just so warped on so many levels. And it wasn't just because of what Barry Bonds did. It's because of what everybody did around him. But yeah, you just go back and you look at, you know, what he did relative to the league. And it's, you can look at Judge this year. You can look at the height of the those Bonds years that we're referring to. And obviously a very Wild West era for performance enhancing drugs. And then you can go back and look at Babe Ruth hitting, you know, 56 homers when nobody else hit 20 in like 1920, 1921. And those are probably, I would think that those have to be considered the greatest offensive seasons in history. There's probably a few more you could come up with, but those are the ones that I think probably leap off the page.
And then the argument becomes, well, that's pre-integration. And I really empathize with that argument because that makes
sense. Right, for sure.
You know, if you take out, if you just had teams filled with with players who mirrored that restriction now, man, who would be the worst pitcher on a roster? It would be someone who would be in double A now, single A. It would be wild. So there's all of that goes into it. I just, the idea, and I will say that Judge right now does remind me of Barry Bonds in that way where he is not getting a ton of pitches to hit. If you plot like all the pitches in the zone on a graph, you can point right away to Aaron Judge as an outlier. Like he is seeing fewer balls in the zone. The other players around him are like Javi Baez and players who don't see baseballs in the zone for obvious reasons because they'll swing at it. But Judge is not seeing all that many balls in the zone, but when he sees one, he's putting a great swing on it. He has that anticipation that Bonds has, maybe not in the same level right now, but that's when he's getting 60 home runs, he's doing it by, I'm just going to take whatever they give me and do some damage on it, and I'm going to be better at it than everyone else. And it's like, so I don't want to be like poo-pooing what Aaron Judge is doing. He's reminding me of Bonds right now. It's really impressive.
Yeah, I went on Fangraphs and I looked at, you know, just what's the zone percentage, and it was, I wish I could quote it right now, but it was in the 40s. And and we don't have zone percentage for like 2001 Barry Bonds. I think the only year we have is 2007. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you're right. It's just so cool, I think, to see somebody who's capturing everyone's attention, and he plays baseball, and that's good. That's good for all of us that love the game or that make our livelihoods in the game. You know, I don't know if it's so great that, you know, the Yankee tickets at Yankee Stadium are in the thousands now. I mean, wow. It's good. The demand is high, but you know, want to see people try to be able to go to games. But yeah, the interest level is it's not quite Maguire Sosa right now, but it's, you know, it's a guy in the biggest media market in the country, you know, doing something, going for an American League record that's, you know, held by, you know, Roger Maris. And it's just so neat. I'm just so glad that he's bringing this much attention and focus to baseball because it's just great for the sport.
It is, and then you get to the part where Friday night's game is going to be on Apple TV Plus, which is a big womp, womp, womp. I mean, nothing you could do. You plan that stuff way in advance, and I get why the teams want that money, but wow, that is unfortunate timing.
How many people are going to buy the little Apple TV set-top thing, thinking that's the only way you get Apple TV Plus? Oh, I guarantee you it's going to be in the thousands, probably in the thousands.
That hurts my heart because you're probably right. That's a good call. I will say that when it comes to Barry Bonds and Aaron Judge, one thing everyone can agree on, Giants legends.
Right. Yeah,
maybe
exactly.
Not yet,
exactly.
But in in the future, in 2030, we'll look back and go, wow, I can't believe that we, as Giants observers, got to watch Barry Bonds and Aaron Judge. What a time, what a time.
Well, this is where you send your self-addressed stamp envelope to Buster Posey, Giants Ownership Group, care of 24 Willie Mays Plaza, San Francisco, California. Yeah, so.
I was a little surprised by the Buster Posey news. I like, it's not like I expected him to disappear into the mists, but it was a little bit of a quick turnaround to get involved so quickly. So that surprised me. Did it surprise you? Was I just looking somewhere else?
That it happened so quick surprised me. But, you know, I had heard that Buster did very, very well for himself, not just in career earnings, obviously, because, you know, I don't think he earned more than $200 million just in career earnings, which, well, only $200 million. But you're talking about a franchise worth like $4 billion. So you're not going to, that's not going to go very far to buy a chunk of the team. But, you know, he's made a lot in endorsements. He was on the ground floor of the Body Armor sports drink. And I think he's cashed out because it wasn't just, he wasn't just, you know, doing the commercials. I think he owned a part of the company, and he had some money to throw around and to park somewhere. And I, you know what? It's just a perfectly smart Buster Posey play, because I could not see him doing what the Giants have some other, you know, of their former legends do, which is, okay, we need you to go to Suite 205 and glad hand there for 15 minutes. And then we need you to go to speak to this group. And, you know, it sort of, you're almost turned into a mascot in a sense. And, you know, it's not to say there's anything wrong with it. I mean, the Giants keeping a connection to their franchise legends is one of the things they do better than anybody, you know, whether it's Will Clark or Barry Bonds or whoever they bring in. And but I just didn't see Buster doing that or being put on that kind of a schedule. He really likes to do things on his own schedule, not sort of have people be counting on his time. And this allows him to honestly just be above the fray, and he can, you know, come and go as he pleases and be as involved as he wants to be. The fact he's got a board seat means that even though he probably doesn't own a significant portion of the team, he's probably like basically an analog to Magic Johnson with the Dodgers. He's still going to have, I think, a lot of influence, and he has had a lot of influence on Greg Johnson, on the other board members. And that's going to be valuable. You know, I talked to Brandon Crawford about it, talked to Evan Longoria about it, and they're thrilled. Although I got to tell you, and I'm writing this now, so if you're listening to this, you may hear this before you read it. But Brandon Crawford said he sent Buster a text message when he heard the news. And his message was, just so you know what you're getting into, I've heard that owning a baseball team isn't a money-making business.
That is so perfect.
Of course, an oblique reference to Rob Manfred's comments during the lockout, where he said that owners can make more on the stock market. So, you know, Brandon Crawford's digital persona, same as the one in person. I love it.
So dry. So dry in the best possible way. I'd want to shout out former McCovey Chronicles writer Doug, who he has a very good newsletter that you should subscribe to, Giants Doug at Substack. He has been going through all of the owners. He has been going through the principal partners of the Giants one by one and crossing them off, and just in a series called Who the Heck is Giants Owner Blank Anyway? And he digs into their business and how they got involved. And his latest one was about Buster Posey. So good. Congratulations. He didn't have to go and dig through to get a lot of material for that one. So he deserves a break.
Yeah, I've done that before in the media guide. You see all the names and you're like, okay, you know, some of these people stand out right away. You know, a lot of them are titans of Silicon Valley, but it's like, okay, Jed Walentis, how many billions are you worth and how did you make it? You know, and it is, it's interesting to see where everybody comes from. It's like at one point they had every spot on the bingo card. They had an Oracle person, they had an Apple person, they had a Hewlett Packard person. And you know, it's changed over the years, and but you know, I think lately the ownership group has been pretty darn stable with who's owned the biggest pieces, and obviously the Johnson family owns the biggest share, and yeah, it is really interesting to see who sits on the board, who has a lot of influence. Rob Dean is an owner that has a lot of influence, of course, married into the Harmon Burns family, and yeah, there's been quite a bit of stability there from that ownership group, and I'm sure that, you know, Buster knows all of them already, which is going to make this transition even easier for him.
If I could go back to 1992, I would have bought a stick. That's what I would have done. It would have appreciated well. I should have been a part owner of the Giants.
You know what? What, $100 million? So, yeah, you put in, let's say, you put in $100. What's the quick math on that? What would $100 be worth if you appreciate from 100,000 to 4 billion? Or, 100 million to 4 billion.
Not only was I told there would be no math, I was promised there would be no math.
Right. Sorry. I don't even know how many zeros. I'm trying to type it right now, and I don't know how many zeros are in billion. I'm giving up.
That's
just
okay.
Yeah, it would have been a good place to park some money in the early 90s.
We are scribes. We are not mathematicians. When my parents bought their season ticket stake, I think they put money down at the groundbreaking, which was 1997. They looked at the condos across the street and said, gosh, it would be a stretch, but it would be nice to buy a little condo for $200,000 and just have a place to flop afterwards. And so they're regretting that almost as much as not buying the Giants.
Yeah, the pied-à-terre that almost was.
Mm-mm-mm. All right, this has been episode 215 of the Bags and Brisby podcast. We will be back next Monday, and we will talk about what the Giants did in Arizona. The entire baseball world will be watching, so we'll see you then.